Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. You're about to listen to an episode of Tech Done Different Podcast with Ted Harrington. Do you follow the pack or challenge the status quo? Join Ted as he explores how to succeed by going against conventional wisdom. You'll hear leaders in technology and security tell stories about how they achieve their success by doing things differently. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Hey everybody, and welcome to another episode of Tech Done Different. As always, I'm your host, Ted Harrington, and with me here today is our special guest, Tom Kulzer, the CEO of Aweber. Tom, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Ted.
Now, Tom, as you and I were chatting about getting ready to prepare what we were going to maybe focus on today, you brought up something that so quickly piqued my interest. And I think we could start talking about responsible disclosure. And what's interesting about this is that you mentioned that you guys have set up a responsible disclosure program. And I'm super fascinated by your experience of it, because as a security research company, we're always on the other side of it. Like, how do we help companies and how do we go through responsible disclosure in ways that work for them? So maybe we start there and then, we can see where the conversation goes, but maybe just briefly introduce kind of what your company is and does so that the listeners have context, and then tell me why you set up a responsible disclosure program.
Sure. So as you mentioned, I'm the CEO of Aweber. We're an email marketing platform for small businesses and creators around the world. So we service about 200 to 250,000 users around the world, and all kinds of, whether they're YouTubers, bloggers, retail establishments, you name it, plumbers, like we've got everybody. And so we are developing a software platform that is used by thousands of people every day, like right this second. Our engineering team is constantly releasing new features and so forth. So we have about 100 team members. A good chunk of them are software engineering that's in-house. So obviously, software and security and best practices are important things to us. So we, trying to think, it was about a year and a half ago or so that we released a responsible disclosure program for the first time. Like, we'd always gotten bug reports from outside, whether it was a bug or whether it was an actual security issue, and, have always promptly, responded to those and resolved those issues, as any responsible software, provider should. It wasn't until that more recent where we kind of like formalized that process and actually put documentation out there for the different kind of categories of exposures that we had, and what the best practices were for disclosing them to us and the general public, and what to expect from us basically when you said, like, hey, you got an issue over here. Okay, now what? And it's been interesting. We've gotten some really good things that were good to get out of the wild. I won't say that we had anything like too crazy severe. Most of them, a lot of stuff was like rate limiting and that sort of jazz around things that, could cause service interruptions if there was like a significant attack on a particular endpoint, but nothing that was like really data security exposure in any, meaningful way. But there's definitely like different types of, reports that you get. There's definitely a huge contingent of automated checks from people running the same software over and over and over on your platform. So being, for us, like one of the biggest takeaways early on was like being prepared for the volume of reports that you're going to get about things that maybe technically are an issue, but like aren't actually an issue in real life. Like it's hard to quantify that without like being really specific about something. but like, you know, I think most of your audience probably understands like the things that, you know, somebody might think is a security vulnerability might actually be a feature of your product, but the person reporting the issue doesn't understand that that's actually a feature. And if you close that hole or whatever it happens to be, like, you fundamentally change how the service works. Those kind of, you know, you spend a fair amount of time like explaining those to people that are reporting issues to you, and reporting, you know, replying back to people that are reporting basically the same thing over and over and over again. That's not actually an issue that we've already looked at, quantified as not an issue, and getting back to people. So it's been, you know, that aspect of developing that kind of like response process and infrastructure to vet whether or not it's an existing issue that we know about and that we've quantified as like not an actual issue versus things that like need to get escalated to our engineering team and like, you know, fixed right away kind of things. So like what's a fire that you need to execute on extremely quickly versus what are things that are like, this isn't a deal. So it's been, you know, it's been interesting. So, and then you get more targeted folks that are doing more manual, like penetration testing and that sort of stuff, which is, I think the, you know, there's always exceptions, but I think it's been interesting to see how many of them get caught in our own internal security mechanisms, like flagged and like accounts deactivated because they're trying to do things that aren't natural, that, you know, end up getting their accounts deactivated on our platform. They have to make many accounts, and then they end up having to like try to circumvent our other security stuff in order to test, you know, a specific piece of security. So it's, you know, we have some security researchers that we have actually vetted as like legitimate folks that we let bypass certain things just so that they can more thoroughly penetration test. So, you know, I think a lot of that boils down to like, what is the, you know, what is the maturity level of the security that you're already running on your platform versus, you know, where many places don't. We've learned a lot of lessons over the 23 years that we've been in business and doing this. So it's, you know, each different type of attack or something like that is another opportunity to learn and another opportunity to put another layer of security there that might not have previously existed. So.
Okay, that's cool. So what I'm hearing you talk about, Tom, there's a lot of things actually in what you just said that I want to talk about, but there's a few in particular that jumped out to me. One, you talked about context. Another, you talked about the distinction between automated versus manual. And then the third was the distinction between, you know, vetted partners that you might work with. So through the course of the conversation, I think we'll wind up hitting all of them, but let's start with context. That was the first thing that you were mentioning, where you're getting vulnerabilities reported to you that's in the context of your business model isn't a problem. The researcher might not know that. Is it accurate to say that, based on what you just said, that that's the sort of majority of what you're receiving, or how do you filter those out?
It's hard to say if I would quantify it as the majority, but it's definitely a noisy contingent of it. You know, I think the first part to filtering some of those out is putting them in your docs. You know, hey, we've identified this area of our software as like, this is the way it's supposed to work. And you might think there's like, you know, JavaScript injection there. We allow JavaScript in there intentionally. So, you know, kind of having that upfront documentation, but also realizing most people don't actually read your documentation that thoroughly beforehand. Yeah. But if you can have your documentation be representative of what you're going to then say back to somebody, it always helps. So that, and then, you know, we have kind of our first line of defense or our first line of triage, I think is probably a better way to describe that, is some of our technical team that interfaces with our customer solutions team. So they're used to dealing with like customer issues and that sort of stuff. And they kind of are the in between like our CS team and like our backend engineering team, just so that they can kind of be in that like jump around focus, you know, not lack of focus kind of
period versus like our engineers that are working on product features, backend upgrades, et cetera, are often like heads down and don't want to deal with the like day-to-day, minute-to-minute kind of interruption that, you know, new emails, new reports or something coming in can require. And that just that context switch, trying to avoid that context switch. So like having one or more people that are dedicated to that has been helpful to avoid the interruptions to our core engineering team that don't need to be interruptions.
That's really fascinating. So if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying that you sort of segment the duties a little bit, even within the people who are responsible for the security actions. Is that the way that you handle
this? Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And you do that in order to reduce or potentially even eliminate some of the switching costs that go from different types of security response activities. That's really fascinating. Yeah. So the first line team, I guess, the team that is figuring out, hey, what should go to the sort of, no priorities, yeah, or I forget how you said it, but the team that can have do whatever, respond to everything. How do they go about that? Do you like look at CVSS scores, or how do you quickly how do you triage what needs what type of attention?
It depends. First, they're just our kind of first line team is really vetting, like, is this a real security issue? You know, like, does this seem sane? Because a lot of stuff you get is just kind of out there. Right. Doesn't make a lot of sense frequently. So first it's like, okay, is this actually a report of something that is a security issue? Do I have enough information to be able to reproduce it myself? And if I do, you know, it's kind of graded on a scale depending on like what kind of issue is it. Is it like a rate limiting thing? Is it a, you know, data compromise where you're in some way publicly disclosing data that you shouldn't? Is it like an account takeover? Like, we have a whole chart internally of like different kind of levels of you know, security incident of some sort. And they're just, you know, based on that chart, it gets prioritized and discussed within our internal Slack teams, and assigned to the correct product team. So like our engineering team is divided up into a couple of different product teams that work on different areas of our overall product. So like, you know, whether it's our message editor for creating content that gets sent out to people, or you know, our subscriber management area, like there's a bunch of different areas that get segmented off. And depending on what the issue is, it might go to one or more teams. So like login stuff goes to a different team than message editor stuff and so forth. So that front end team kind of divides that out and then kind of waves the appropriate flag at the product owner or at the tech lead of those teams as to whether or not, like, hey, is this an issue that you can get to it in a couple of weeks? Or is this an issue that, you know, three people need to stop what they're doing right this second and do nothing but this until it's done and fixed. You know, and being able to make that call to avoid the interruption, you know, because at the end of the day, we're trying to ship product features for users, not, you know, the back of office maintenance that security stuff often is.
So that's super fascinating, because I'm hearing you describe efficient engineering practices is what you've applied to security. You're like, how do I do this the easiest way that I can?
Pretty much. Cool.
Now, these people that you have, do you find that in your experience, it sounds like you guys have built what seems to be an effective responsible disclosure program. In your experience, do you find that you needed to hire security people to handle all the ingest stuff, or are these engineers that you've taught the security part?
These are engineers, that have been taught the security part or knew it. You know, like all engineers have to deal with some elements of security in what they're doing, just whether they're writing APIs and input validation and, you know, rate limiting and SQL injection, like you name it. Like that's kind of core fundamentals to a good software engineer is, you know, the world is angry and mean and will input all kinds of stuff that you don't expect into your product to do bad things. You have to be attuned to what those are so that you don't let bad stuff get out in the wild and, you know, expose your users in some sort of way. So,
oh man, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, that's the heart of security, is identifying these assumptions that we make about how a system will or will not work. And then looking at it differently. Cause there's bad people out there who are going to say, oh, it's not supposed to do X. I'm going to make it do X.
Yeah.
Even if it wasn't built to do
like, even amongst our engineering team, like I'm pretty active with our overall product development team. And like one of the first things I do when we get new product that's, you know, in our staging environment before it goes out to production, it's, you know, I'll start mashing whatever input I know they think I should make. I don't do that. I do something completely different. Mm. And like, that's, you know, often where you catch people with their pants down around, you know, expecting a certain type of input, but you give it something else and then it blows up as a result. Mm-hmm. So it's just such an important kind of fundamental piece of security. So for any software platform.
One of the things that you've described that I think is very difficult, and I'm curious to how you've approached it, is taking somebody who thinks in a certain way and then asking them to think in a different way. I mean, that's the whole premise of this show, certainly. And, you know, people who are engineers, computer scientists, people who build things think one way. And then ethical hackers, security researchers, people who break things, they think a different way. And what you've described is the builders now have to think like the breakers. How have your people dealt with that? I mean, that's certainly, there's some dissonance there. I think for a lot of people, it's like, it doesn't match that line of thinking. How do your people do it?
I think obviously some people are better at it than others. Mm-hmm. You know, people that suck at it don't get to you know, review RDP reports for their validity. Like, you know, but at the same time, like we have kind of a retro process around different kind of security incidents like that, so that our teams that don't necessarily think like that, you know, or individuals that don't necessarily think the same way, are exposed to the stuff that gets out in the wild that, you know, that takes advantage of their software, so that they gain awareness over time. You know, there's kind of an institutional knowledge that gets built over time, you know, through documentation, through QA process, through automated testing that's looking at different inputs. And, you know, is when we find something that in some way takes advantage of something that we didn't previously have automated coverage for, we'll add that to automated coverage, you know, suites, so that you're not missing it future. You know, one of the biggest, you know, no software engineer is ever happy with the code that they put out the first time. Sure. I always want to rewrite everything. And, you know, one of the things I think that they often, you know, they look at the code like structurally as, this is a thing that I can improve by rewriting it from the ground up. But what they miss in that process oftentimes is the many layers or months or even years or perhaps decade or more of iterations on that software that have made it better, you know, that have taken all the little edge cases and fixed them over time with bug reports and otherwise. Whereas when you then go and like completely restart and rebuild that same software from the ground up, you're basically imploding all of that institutional knowledge and all of the years of that software being out in the wild and running, you know, well, just because it's not written in, you know, a modern language that, you know, somebody that you're hiring out of school today wants to deal with. So it's, you're constantly kind of balancing that act and figuring out how you educate people for all the things that you've already dealt with. Like, I've seen all 23 years. Not many of our engineering team have seen that many of the years. So they don't know what happened beforehand. They don't know about the, you know, DDoS attacks before. They don't know about the, you know, rate limiting, you know, things that where people have tried to script different stuff to, you know, brute force their way through something. And they haven't learned those lessons. So it's how do you push that to new folks? Without spending like all your time training. So right. Like we do a lot of documentation internally, a lot of those automated processes, you know, even kind of, we use our own product to like drip feed people education as well, so that it's not just like a, here's the book.
Yeah, have fun.
You know what I mean? So yeah.
Right. So that's interesting. And certainly automation is an interesting element to this too. And you brought up earlier that you note the difference between sort of the overwhelming sometimes series of automated results that you might get from your responsible disclosure program versus the more manual ones. And I certainly agree with the distinction there and argue it heavily.
Everybody likes a good burp suite report, you know?
I mean, it's, you know, tools, they have a role, but the problem is when it's run like it's the entire security approach. So
sure.
When you're seeing more manual results come in, what's your experience with those? It sounds like these are maybe they take your business context into better consideration. These are maybe more sophisticated issues. What's your experience when you receive the more manual type results?
The more manual ones I don't have the specific data in front of me at the moment, but like kind of anecdotally based on the data that I've seen from our team, I'd say most of the manual ones that we get have tended to come from somebody that had an automated exposure before that has been paid out in some way. Like we've paid them, you know, a disclosure, you know, kind of thank you fee. Yeah. And those folks, you know, they tend to look at it as like, hey, you know, this is a good company that when I disclose something of value, you know, they compensate me accordingly. And so those folks that we've paid out in the past tend to do more manual analysis, which, you know, leads to a better, you know, better disclosures, in, you know, going forward. So it's, you know, making sure that you're appropriately compensating people for the time that they're investing to like, look at your platform closer than, you know, than anybody other than your own team is going to look at it. Like your customers don't look at your product like that. Right. And it really requires that special mind to be able to look at it and kind of dissect things and, you know, kind of go from there. But I think valuing their time turns into them spending more time that's more valuable for us in the long run.
I just heard you describe such an incredibly powerful sentiment. And I want to make sure that we state this again, because there is so much nonsense out there where researchers are investing their time and effort, submitting vulnerabilities to companies, and companies oftentimes don't respond. Sometimes when they do respond, they refuse payment. And this usually is happening in sort of a mistaken implementation of vulnerability disclosure programs or bug bounty programs. But what I heard you say was the process is, when you receive the results, pay the researchers. They're going to come back and give you more valuable results because they got a positive benefit out of it. And that's good for you as well. That's what I heard you say. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It's not rocket science, but most people mess that stuff up. Yeah. You know, complicated.
We worked with a company where we went through their vulnerability disclosure program and we submitted the issue. They acknowledged the receipt of the issue. Then they said, well, this issue already exists, so we're not going to pay you, and you're prevented from talking about it. And we're like, you have to compensate a researcher in one of two ways, right? Either you got to pay them the money, or you got to allow them to talk about it. The sort of like hoarding of information is, it's very anti-researcher, and the result is the opposite of what you said. It makes researchers not want to help these companies anymore.
Yeah. I find most of the researchers that we've had an interaction with, they just want to get paid at the end of the day. It's not like they're not usually looking to write up research reports and all that kind of stuff. It's usually this is either a side business that they kind of run where they do kind of security analysis and hope to get paid by companies that have, you know, disclosure programs with payments. But it's usually, I would say it's more, you know, I'd like to get paid. At the end of the day, like if I'm spending time on something, we all like to get compensated for that. I'm not doing it out of the goodness of my heart. Most people are not sitting around like reporting security things as like, oh, you know, I love you guys so much. Like, I want to make sure that everything's cool and, you know, you're protected. Like they want to get paid. Yes. So they spent time, had specialized knowledge and pay them.
Yeah, so. I can tell you for a fact that security researchers want a form of compensation, but it's not necessarily always getting paid money. It is, there are other things that researchers do value too. And research, you know, being able to publish it certainly is one, being able to go to DEF CON or Black Hat or whatever. But yeah, like giving them something. So, because.
And at the end of the day, I look at like an RDP program, if it's too expensive to run, like if we have to make too many payouts, then our software engineering process in and of itself needs to be fixed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like you shouldn't have that many escape defects that are getting out there where somebody, you know, is finding something that you need to pay out a substantial sum for. You know, so if that is the case, you should be really looking closely at your engineering process so that you're not getting those kind of big things out there. Most of the stuff that we've had is kind of like nothing that I would quantify as severe. I wouldn't want to talk about it, frankly, if it was too severe.
Right, right.
But we've had quite a few little things. And it's just like edge cases that's like, oh, okay, that's cool. It's good that we got that, you know, taken care of.
Yeah. And so then you know about it.
Just makes the platform better for everybody. Yeah. Yep. So,
and that right there, that's the whole ethos of, I mean, certainly of security, but of building great products, right? Is to make them better. Like you're constantly evolving it. And I mean, you hit the nail on the head when you talked about how engineers, as soon as they release it, they want to rewrite the whole thing. And
yeah.
So within your company, and I guess over the years you've been doing this, how have you instilled that ethos and process of wanting to get better? I mean, it seems to me that you believe that based on the way you're talking about your company. You go hire somebody, they're 6 months into the role. How do they know what you believe? How does that get transferred?
I think, you know, it starts with the hiring process. I think, you know, beyond that, it's really there. We talk about this in our executive team regularly. It kind of comes down to like the things that people do without being told to do them. Like it's the ownership of issues, and, you know, moving something forward, not because somebody told you that you needed to do that, but because you recognize that it needed to be done and you kind of own that process and move that forward. I think that's, you know, for us anyway, those are the people that are adding the most value to the organization and, you know, are being the best stewards of what it, you know, of their craft. You know, it's kind of the overall passion that somebody has for what they do. You know, if you're just showing up to like work on Jira tickets and go home at the end of the day, like, yeah, like, I guess that technically qualifies you as like a software engineer, but like, have some passion for what you're right. doing, you know, and it's passion, not just for like writing good code. It's also passion for the problem set that your code solves and like helping our end users at the end of the day and like understanding what our end users are doing and what their problems are so that you can as an engineer, you can take your talents as an engineer and apply them to solve our customers' problems by actually understanding our customers' problems and not just like reading what our product owner or UX team might have written about how a customer uses, but like asking enough questions to understand how Mary or Catherine or Joe is actually using the product to solve the problems. Because oftentimes an engineer can suggest hey, there might be an easier way to do this. You know, feedback comes from many a different angle. So I think it's hard to... It's hard to quantify. You know, engineers want to quantify everything. It's really hard to quantify, but when you see it, you know it. And I think it's important to highlight and constantly praise the people that are showing those key traits. And then for the ones that aren't, constantly be pointing out why they're not the ones that are getting the praise and be explicit. Like, I think too many people avoid uncomfortable conversations just because it makes them a little uncomfortable, but ultimately they don't get better as a result of just like giving the softball review and giving the softball like, hey, good job. That was great.
Yeah.
But you could have also done this, this, and this to make it even better. So I often am accused of ignoring the 90% that is really awesome and focusing on the 10% that needs improvement. So it can be both good and bad.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly good advice, right? I'm going to interpret some of what you said here, but to point out, you know, say that was good, more of that, and that was bad, less of that. And those are effective coaching techniques is what I'm hearing you say to help, yeah. you know, cultivate the right behaviors that you're looking for.
Yes, absolutely.
And you mentioned this idea that I think is really cool about making sure that, you know, starting from the problem and understanding the customer, understanding the customer's problem, be passionate about solving the problem. What's the advice for the members of our audience out there who maybe think they understand their customer's problem, but maybe haven't thought yet about how to probe deeper into understanding it, maybe at levels that they don't yet understand? You've been solving this particular problem for your customers for 23 years. So you've certainly probably thought about it in a number of different ways. How have you adapted that over time, and sort of what's the advice to others trying to understand their customer's problem?
I think, you know, obviously, like, first and foremost, talk to customers. Like, just have a conversation. Like, exactly what we're doing here today, just talk to people, ask questions, be inquisitive, like, want to understand why. You know, particularly in the software world, I think too many people are quick to take, you know, a customer asking for feature X and saying, we need to go build feature X, versus really understanding what the problem is that the customer is trying to solve with feature X. Because oftentimes the thing that you build to solve that problem could be entirely different than what they initially asked for, and could probably be a lot better by really understanding what they're, you know, kind of gets into some of the, like, you know, product building products and product vision and that sort of thing. But I think at the end of the day, for engineers specifically, you know, more of your audience here, is just talk to the actual end users that are using the thing that you're building. You know, go-betweens, whether it's product owners, UX folks, UI folks, designers, like, they're valuable and they can aggregate many people's, you know, opinions and feedback and data from that, you know, the research data there, but there's nothing that beats a conversation with an actual end user. You know, like, we call it, I'm blanking on the acronym. It's, internally it's SEEKS. It's like customer engagement. I'm butchering it. They'll laugh at me when they see this. Yeah, totally. But basically it's a program where we have, our engineering team actually works directly with our customer solutions team, where they are actively directly helping our customers and kind of shadowing our CS team live, whether it's on phone, live chats, emails, et cetera. So they see, like, end user problems and can talk about it with our customer solutions team, and ask questions of, like, hey, does this happen a lot? Like, what are the circumstances of this happen? So that when they go back to building whichever product team that they're on and the area of the product that they're focusing on, they can say, like, hey, as an engineer, that problem that we're having earlier today that, you know, Catherine has also said that, like, 10 other people have had the same issue in the last week. Like, that's actually, like, a 3-minute engineering fix. Like, you know, it's one, you know, Git merge and poof, it's out in production and it solves a problem for a bunch of people, versus, like, it bubbling up through the product process and non-technical people having to realize, like, oh, that's actually a really simple thing. Like, an end engineer can look at it and say, that's a really simple thing. And so having that customer context can help iterate your product a lot faster than if you were just kind of gated off behind that whole product development process. So I, you know, particularly in a smaller company, like, we're 100 people, but we're still small enough where everybody can touch all the different areas of the business. And I think that you build better software the more connected you are with the end users. Yeah. So just getting rid of those bottlenecks is so key.
I hear you, man. Well, Tom, you've been absolutely incredibly fascinating to talk to. Thank you for spending our time here together today. As we wrap up, one last question for you. You know, any final parting thoughts that you want to share with our audience?
Parting thoughts with your audience? Yeah, goodness. I would say just, like, whatever the thing is that you're not starting because you think that there's some particular bottleneck around starting it, like, just start it. I feel like so often we bottleneck ourselves on these preconceived, like, oh, I can't do it because of this reason, this reason, this reason. Forget about all of them and just do something, because something is better than nothing. And often that whole agile methodology of not software development, but just being agile and do something, get it out there, get feedback, and then iterate on it from there. It's not going to be perfect the first time that it's out, but just keep pushing forward and you'll get to where you want to go.
I love it. That's such great advice. Tom Colzer, thank you so much for spending time with us here today. And for everybody listening, if you want to learn more about the show or to potentially appear on the podcast yourself, just head over to tedharrington.com/podcast. And hopefully I know how to say my own name right. And we will catch you next time. Thanks.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Tech Done Different podcast with Ted Harrington. If you learned something new and this conversation made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.